Hello, everybody.
I'm Margaret Chowning, a member of the History Department, but also more relevant for today's meeting, chair of the Moses Lectureship Committee. We are pleased, along with the Graduate Division, to present Marianne Mason, this year's speaker in the Bernard Moses Memorial Lecture Series. As a condition of Professor Moses' bequest, we are obligated to tell you how the endowment supporting the lectures came to UC Berkeley. In 1937, University of California President Robert Gordon Sproul and the UC Board of Regents established the Bernard Moses Memorial Lectureship in the Social Sciences. The lectureship honors the memory of the late Bernard Moses, a professor of history and political science at the University of California from 1875 to 1911, and an emeritus professor from 1911 until his death in 1930. Professor Moses earned a worldwide reputation for his contributions to understanding the problems of the Latin American republics, and he was a pioneer scholar of Latin American history. Professor Moses served as a member of the United States Philippine Commission from 1900 to 1904. Past lecturers have included Herma Hill Kay, Lloyd Ullman, Nicholas Ryasanovsky, George Lakoff, Kenneth Stamp, Eugene Hamill, Ken Jowett, Carolyn Merchant, Jean Lave, and Emmanuel Saez. Now I'd like to say a few words about today's lecturer, Marianne Mason. Professor Mason is currently a professor of the Graduate School and faculty co-director of the Earl Warren Institute for Law and Social Policy at the UC Berkeley School of Law. Mason is an influential force in the areas of family law, policy, and child custody issues. Her lecture today, in part inspired by her forthcoming book, Do Babies Matter? Gender and Family in the Ivory Tower, which, according to Amazon, is coming out in May. Does that sound right?
July.
This book will ask why female doctoral graduates do not follow the same career trajectories as men after receiving their degrees. Drawing on 12 years of research, Mason traces the effect of family formation on women from graduate school through retirement. This follows on her more recent work concerning the issues that professional women face in law, medicine, science, and academia. Marianne Mason received a PhD in American history from the University of Rochester and a JD from the University of San Francisco. After teaching American history and practicing law, Mason joined the faculty of UC Berkeley in 1989 and served as a professor in the Graduate School of Social Welfare until 2007. Between the year 2000 and 2007, Mason served as the first woman dean of the graduate division at UC Berkeley. She was and is a strong advocate for graduate student diversity, equity for student parents, and career life balance for all faculty. Her research is a foundation for UC system-wide initiatives, including the UC Family Friendly Edge and the nationwide Nine Presidents Summit on Gender Equity. Please join me in welcoming Professor Marianne Mason.
Thank you, Margaret. I'm very honored to be at the Moses Lecture this year and to be able to speak to my family, my Berkeley family, my favorite people, and my actual biological family is here as well. Where are you? You didn't sneak out already. My daughter, even my husband, Paul. I'm particularly glad to be here because, as Margaret mentioned, this actually represents 12 years of research, and you have been my experimental subjects for most of this time, as you will learn. So you might be able to see yourself in some of these pictures and charts and graphs, because we have been studying you and the whole UC system. This started, actually, when I first became the graduate dean at Berkeley in the year 2000. And I have to say, as an old 70s feminist, I was thrilled to see that a little more than 50% of the entering class were women. Unbelievably exciting to me. Thought we'd never see this in my lifetime. The graduate students were less impressed because that's what they grew up with and didn't realize how different things had been. So As you can see from this, or maybe you can see from this because I've got to figure it out. Yes, there we go. In terms of the rise of women PhDs, in 1973 it's 20%, and now it's actually a little more than 50%. I got a PhD in 1973, actually, and it was only 12% of my class were women, so that doesn't surprise me. I got a law degree after that, and only 10% of my class were women. Now, law school is well over 50%, and certainly graduate degrees in history, as you know, are probably over 60% as well. So things have changed greatly. Amazing within my lifetime to see such change. And it's not just overall. It's also in the sciences, which everyone said was going to be stuck in wherever forever. But in fact, since 1973, you've seen huge growth in lots of fields. In psychology, it's 71% now. Even in the field of engineering, of all places, it's over 22%. Coming from zero, that's a really pretty good jump. And similarly, you have geoscience and math and science are really going up very fast. Altogether, about a little less than 30% of all PhDs in the sciences are now granted to women. So this is enormously impressive progress. However, I looked around me, and there are some issues here. So this is a test, and the winner either gets Starbucks or bourbon, depending on your predilection. So what do you think this diagram resembles? I mean, the figure on the right has got kind of a masculine hulk to him, and the woman on the right's got those little bulgy hips. It's hard to know. So what do you think it is? Start at the top. It's the easiest. The two heads there. There's the 987 and the 325. And this is Berkeley. And Paula, you probably know the answer. Anyone else want to guess what this might be? The heads. No, actually, tenure-track professors. We're kind of a shrinking faculty. 987 to 325 of tenure-track. That includes assistant as well as associate and full. And the most important story here, though, as it is in general in higher education, are the necks. You see that women have tiny heads and thickish necks compared with the little skinny necks that the men have. What do you think the neck is? Yes. Adjuncts, part-times, lecturers on this campus. Doesn't include graduate students, just the adjuncts, part-time, and lecturers. Now, the necks are the fastest-growing part of higher education. It's really a stunning figure in the other direction, not a good direction. About 20 years ago, something like 58% of all undergraduates were taught by tenure-track professors, and now that's down to 37%, and going down further. The model has been to shrink the professoriate and raise the fungible workplace, the workplace that is cheap and can move on. Now, this is only Berkeley, because we're not really doing this with the other slides, but what do you think the 3,000 and 4,000 are? Pardon me? There are a lot of them. Could have been graduate students, you're right, but it's not. It's actually the staff. And the staff have, because there are a lot of technical people and people who work in the labs, the men have higher paid jobs, so those are the broad shoulders, and women not so much. And then at the bottom, the female bulge there are lots of just, at school like this, residence workers and restaurant workers, et cetera, who are women. So this is the face of Berkeley, but it actually is the face of most American corporations, and certainly all other major universities. I've had people look at this diagram and do their own, and it's very similar. It's what's happened since the feminist revolution. Huge numbers of women in the workplace, but taking the bottom half, and with some representation at the top, but not too much, much more in the middle management, the neck positions in the corporate world, and in our world, it's the basically the gypsy scholars. This is a little distressing. I knew this, of course. It wasn't a great surprise to me, and I wanted to look at it more carefully for my students to see what was going to happen, and more importantly, for the university to see it and to take some steps. So what happens to men and women after they get their PhDs? How does having babies affect tenure? We had a wonderful data set to use. How many PhDs are in this audience? There you go. I knew it. There'd be a lot of you. So every one of you, if you got a PhD before or after 1973, filled it out once, the survey of earned doctorate. We don't let you graduate from the graduate division unless you fill out that survey. So that's the base, and 10% of all PhDs are followed through every 2 years until they are 76, dead, or have left the country. It is very hard to escape NSF. Just don't even try. So that is 160,000 participants, and arguably it is the best employment longitudinal database that we have in America. You can ask questions from this database that you're not going to find, even, for instance, for doctors or lawyers. They don't have this kind of database. So we're really fortunate because you can really pinpoint when and how family formation makes a difference. Who gets tenure? Do you see the old familiar heads and necks again? So what is it? Well, we can see the guy on the right here, Guy. You know, we're used to thinking of him as Guy now in blue. 78% of those who go into academia, of the men, get tenure. And 22% go into the second tier, full-time faculty, part-time faculty, non-tenure faculty. Those are the fathers. The fathers actually, men, married men, do better than anyone else in the university in terms of promoting up the ladder. They do better than single men. They do better than single women. They do better, a lot better than married women with children. The women with late or no babies do pretty well. They're kind of in between, 71%, and they have a somewhat bigger neck. Late or no babies, by our definition, late is really about over age 40 because it's any time post-PhD, 5 years post-PhD. The average PhD is now given at age 34, so you're really flirting around age 40 when you're talking about a late baby. So anything over 40 would be a late baby. There aren't too many of those. There's no difference between a late baby over 40 or an early baby, but early babies make a huge difference. And this is any time, again, before about the age of 40. And you can see that the women who have the big necks are disproportionately women, married women with children. Now, the interesting part is, here's the science world. Same pattern. As you find out, things are tougher for women in science in some ways, but the patterns are remarkably similar to what happens in the humanities and social sciences. In this case, you see smaller numbers because there are fewer scientists to begin with, so the heads and necks and whatever are disproportionately, it's 3,000 and 3,000. And then the men have the same big heads and same looking neck. In this case, however, the women with later no babies in science do not do that well. They actually have a lot of trouble getting tenure, even if they don't have babies. And those who have babies do pretty miserably, 53% to 77%. So this is the way academia has been playing out. And it hasn't changed much, these kinds of images, probably for the last 10 years or so. It's been fairly stable. Now, look at it in a different way. It shows a kind of a timeline here of falling out of the pipeline. And this is, again, everybody. It's not just the scientist. And you see the biggest leak in the pipeline, and this is true in science as well, is before taking that first assistant professor job. Women are likely to drop out, as you'll see in a moment, as postdocs or change their minds as graduate students. They have already decided, hell no, I won't go, and don't take that. It's the pool problem, as we call it, because when you're trying to hire for a new position, you find you don't have as many women applying for it proportional to the numbers. So this is a familiar one. And then women are 27% less likely to become associate professors. In other words, they just don't get tenure. And women lag in on those slow years of being an associate professor forever. So 20% less likely after 16 years of being an associate professor to be a full professor. So you see it all the way up. But for women in general, it's really the younger years, the postdocs and the graduate students, where you see the biggest change. They just don't enter the pipeline at all. And here you have, no, I'm going the wrong way, here you have women in science. Now, the interesting part about women in science is that single women actually take that first job, that first tenure track job, just about in the same proportion as married fathers do. So they're really on an even keel up to that point. And then single women take a big tumble and don't get tenure. But the interesting part about it, it's not just the mother effect. There are more complicated things going on in science. I have been studying science, the women scientists now for the last 2 or 3 years, and the complexity of the implicit bias and the stereotyping and the gender discrimination are really quite serious in the sciences. They're across the board, but not quite as much as in the science. And in the sciences, married mothers are 35% less likely than married fathers to take a tenure track, and married mothers drop out 27% less than married fathers with young children to become tenure. So scientists take a bigger hit, no question, with motherhood. But it's not just scientists who take the hit. The patterns are there. It's just tougher in science. And I think the women, are there women scientists in this room? Is that your perception? Yes, it is. And I think women scientists get much more discouraged in early age, too, so they're more likely to drop out, which is what we're really trying to aim at. These are postdocs. Now, in the UC system, we have just about as many postdocs as we have doctoral students in all the system itself, about 8,000 of them, I think. And the most dramatic thing, we actually have tons of data on our UC postdocs, because in addition to the survey of doctorate recipients, we did several original studies. This is where you're probably part of it. How many are faculty members here? There we go. In 2003, there was a UC family survey, which became our backbone and has been brought up to date really by the climate survey. And then in 2005, we did all the doctoral students. How many doctoral students are in the office? Okay, you might have done this, or you might not have been here in 2005. And then in 2007, we did the postdocs. We have this whole series. Again, the biggest data set for these classes of workers of any in the United States. No one has that kind of data for graduate students, postdocs, or faculty. That gives you a kind of a heft and power. But it's a distinct drop-off there. 41% who have a new child since they became a postdoc say they've changed their opinion and they're no longer going to become a research scientist at an academic institution. 41% versus fathers who become children. I didn't say that. Who have children, right. And those who had children previous to a postdoc, again, you see a big slide. They just find that postdoc years just too tough. Other kinds of criteria when we measured, the women with children are far less likely to go to conferences, which is the lifeblood of networking and getting a job. They're far less likely to have a good relationship with their mentor, which is not very helpful either, because your mentor is the person who most helps you through life. So postdocs have a serious disadvantage and show it by just dropping out of the pipeline. And for women, for scientists, I think that's really critical, because we spend about $500,000 at least to educate, the federal government does, to educate scientists through their PhD and their postdoc, and then they leave just because we don't do much to help them stay. It's not a very good use of funds. And this is our graduate students. Now, you all, I'm sure, know the graduate students quite well. They changed their career goal as well. We did a snapshot, but we asked them, have you changed your career goal since you entered? And at the beginning of entering their postdoc program, not the postdoc, their graduate program, women, 46%, wanted to be a professor in a research institution. But if they had a baby, and these are all women in the sciences, that number absolutely plummeted to 11%, basically getting rid of all the mothers who had babies as doctoral students. For fathers, beginning number was 58%, and that went down to 45%. So it had an effect, but not the drastic effect that childbirth has. So childbirth is really the major reason, I think, why, and certainly the sciences, the women do not look as strong as men going through the pipeline. They start out pretty well, 30%, and then they go down pretty rapidly. Okay. Now here, these are our own sweet graduate students, and you've probably heard remarks like this, or maybe you haven't. The women all uniformly, in just the off the comments, the freehand comments, I want to be able to have a family, have children, enjoy being a mother and wife, which are close to impossible when one chooses academia. The clock is ticking, and it will not stop for anything or anyone. And then here we see the guy fed up with the narrow-mindedness of supposedly intelligent people who are largely workaholic and expect others to be so as well. He's sick of it too. So both men and women change their mind, but women more than men, and almost always for family reasons, a significant difference in that regard. And it's true that both men and women, the majority, believe that their university, which is one of our UCs, is not at all family friendly, so we don't have a good example. How many of you have had women graduate students say, I don't want to live your life? Yes, we've had that, exactly. Doesn't do well as an example. So here's a repeat of this first part of the study. Again, this is over many, many studies and over several years, but just compiling it together. Married mothers are 35% less likely to enter tenure-track jobs than married fathers. Married mothers are 27% less likely to achieve tenure than married fathers. And mothers often make their decisions early. Twice as many women than men are likely to change their career goal away from being a research professor when they have babies as postdocs. High percentage of mothers slide into the second tier, the NEC, the part-time adjunct and lecture corps, the gypsy scholars of the university world. You know, I was a gypsy scholar for a while. Anyone else been a gypsy scholar in this class? There you go. It is the least well-paid, least respected, high-educated discipline in this country in terms of a job. It really is just at the bottom of the bill. No respect, no money, no continuity, et cetera. And yet you find so many women and men, but largely women, doing it because it's really the only way they can continue on in the university, or think it is. And then, after several years, we'd gotten this pretty well organized and figured out when women were dropping out, et cetera, it occurred to me, and several others actually, that there was another important question to address, that equity was not just looking at the numbers of women compared with men who get tenure, it was also looking at the family formation of those professors. What did women have to give up if they wanted to go all the way? What was the effect of career on family formation? Taking the question on its head. And here you see it even more drastically than you see in terms of the numbers. These are across all fields, tenured faculty. And the discrepancy between men and women is huge. Married women with children, 44%. Married with children, 70% for men. Women are twice as likely to be single. The only group that is more similar are married without children. But the marriage penalty, not the marriage penalty, the tenure penalty for fertility is very high. And here you see it in the sciences. This is a better drawn diagram, and you get the scale of it. Because as you can see, women are a little teeny ball up there, a little teeny satellite around a huge moon, because the men are much larger in science. When you see it this way, you see both the numbers and the fact that there's a discrepancy, a double gender equity issue, a discrepancy in having children. So here in sciences, it's 73% to 53%. Interestingly enough, women scientists are more likely to be married than women in the humanities and social sciences. Anyone have a guess of why that might be? The numbers are good. The proportion of numbers are good. You're outnumbered by men all the time, so the odds are good. But as they say, the goods might be odd, as they say in Alaska. But nonetheless, so they have a little bit better advantage in terms of being married mothers, actually, than fathers do. And so many of them already dropped out that it's... you're not seeing, of course, the whole thing. Single mothers, 8%, and married without children, 15%. Basically, getting divorced is also an area with a lot of discrepancy. As you can see, latter-ranked women are the most likely to be divorced, and the least likely to be divorced are the second-tier women, because they've chosen that life, because they can't afford to be divorced. I don't know, but it clearly is a different pattern for second-tier women. And this is really quite interesting. It's the census data, and it compares women faculty with women lawyers to women doctors. And women faculty are really much less likely to have children, as you can see. Doctors, however, women in medicine do almost as well as all college-educated women. And that seems to be contradictory, because we know how hard it is and what the time dimensions are for women in medicine. But as one of my friends said, who was a resident at the time, she said, "Marianne, we just have to put in the hours. We don't have to get tenure." So by the time they're in their residency, they don't have the pressure of publication, which is a very different kind of thing for women. And they also have something to look forward to. I think medicine is really unrolling itself as being a far more flexible career track for women. They have a lot of HMOs or places like Kaiser where people can work 50%, 60%, and still have high status, high salary, etc. It's also true that women are more likely to be family doctors or things that are not high prestige, like surgeons, etc. So there's a little bit of a second tier effect, but nonetheless, and they actually earn 50% less than men because they work fewer hours, but still they can maintain their career and not be washed out. Only 5% of women doctors actually leave practicing medicine, which is quite astounding. And they have more children. They have more children in part because they're also richer. This is the problem with, what's the name of the woman who just the woman in Silicon Valley who took the job while pregnant. What's her name? It says, right. I mean, she has a baby, and she says, there's no problem here, but then she also has a staff of God knows how many. So this is, and Sheryl Sandberg as well. So it's very easy for women who are in that position to say, of course you can do it. Just lean in. Just take it. Just be tough about it. And I think most academic women do not have that luxury, unless you're married to someone in Silicon Valley, which most of us aren't. So again, the years from 20 to 30 in all professions are really the make or break years. You have to make it in your profession, whether you're a lawyer or a doctor, but even more so as an academic, because you don't usually get a second chance. If you don't get tenure, you're likely not to stay in the academic market. And it's a very intense and clear 5, 6, 7 years. So although it's true in all professions, it's even more intense for women in the academic profession. I call it the make or break decade. And now you can see in terms of childbirth here, the little long line there is the higher date. And at that age, most people are around 35 these days, 35, 36. And then you see the men and women. These are the years in which they have children. This is the percentage of children they have. Now, men have children, babies, early and often, and through their assistant professor years, right to the right of the higher date, they have a lot of children. Women come more slowly, and only 1 year do they make a big burst, and that's 4 to 6 years. That's the tenure year. They've got their case in, and now it's time to have the baby. And then after that, it goes down fairly quickly. So the tenure year has been the most popular year. The problem with that is the tenure year comes later and later than it did in the past. So it's often over 40, and it's waiting quite a long time. So you see that it goes down very quickly. Now, surprisingly, how can this be? 20 or more years past being hired, you have a little boomlet here on the right at the end of the curve. What could that possibly be? It's all men, too. The second marriage, yes. A familiar story. Although I have to tell you something. I'm not going to talk about retirement, but the one factoid of retirement, which is kind of interesting, there isn't much difference between men and women in terms of the age at which they retire, with the exception of those who still have children in the household don't retire, can't ever retire. And that is largely going to be men. So there is that's the only differential you really see at the end of the career. Here again, just summing it up, only 1 in 3 women without children who takes a fast-track university job ever become mothers. That's if you enter a tenure-track job without children, you're not likely to have children. It's also because of the age and other things. Women are far less likely to be married with children than are men, 53% to 73%. Women who achieve tenure are more and twice as likely than men who achieve tenure to be single 12 years out from PhD. Now, I'm really sorry there's students in this audience because this is when the hankies come out. It just sounds so hopeless. But you will see there is good news following this. It's not as bad as it seems. And if married, women are significantly more likely than men to experience divorce or separation. Now it's getting sadder. Women faculty were more than twice as likely as men faculty to indicate they wish they could have more children. That was actually from our UC faculty survey. Now, can you read this? "I can't believe I forgot to have children." Now, most of you probably don't remember the 80s, but those of you who do, this was a shirt that was very popular, and it was a backlash against the feminist movement. You know, you've given it up, you've given up motherhood. And I mean, the thing that's sad about it is there's still some truth to it, more than some truth to it, that it hasn't quite worked out the way that we had hoped it would in terms of having children. Having it all, as they say, is very difficult. And we are making progress, though, as you will see. I think I went the wrong direction. Oh, no, I'm just recapitulating about the family status of tenure faculty all field. That is, it's a double equity problem because it's both the number of women who are full professors and also the family configuration of those who are. So it's double trouble, as I think of it. And here again are the women scientists with their little orbs going around. So until we actually reach equity in both areas, we can't say that we have reached any kind of equity in terms of the university world. Now, what are your next steps? The good news is we actually, in the last 10 years, have been very active ones for Berkeley, for the UC system, and for pretty much all universities. There's been a lot of positive action, and things are happening every day, and largely good things, to make the workplace more flexible, to change the culture, and to try to keep our women students in the pipeline and not let babies derail them. This is compiling all together all the many kinds of workplace strategies, and I'm happy to say that Berkeley now has pretty much all of them. We have, in terms of leaves, parental leave for mothers and fathers. As you probably know, there's an active service modified duty of one semester for mothers, two semesters for mother, and one for dads if they are significant or generally fair about the distribution of childcare. They have to be doing it at least 50% of the time. And as you may have noticed in your department, the men are taking this. This is not something that is unappreciated or unknown. We have centralized funding for maternity or parental leaves. That was important as well because some departments resent it very much if they have to pay money to hire lecturers. So that was made part of the original deal. And these are all part of a number of initiatives that started in 2004. After we'd published our initial studies, it became a very important political campaign to take this to Atkinson and then to take it to the chancellors and then to take it to the deans, et cetera, to sell the fact that we wanted to have centralized, flexible, family-friendly policies. And we put in place a great number of them between 2004 and 2005. There was a real fight over some of these. The one that was most contentious was the part-time tenure track. And now, for family reasons, you can have a part-time pre-tenure or post-tenure track of up to 5 years. According to Regents' rules, you have to have tenure by the time you've been in here 10 years. So that's sort of the upper limit for pre-tenure. But for post-tenure, it's usually 5 years. Sometimes it can be longer. People have family needs all during their life. They have them with their spouse, with themselves, with their families, et cetera. So it's a lifelong issue. And that's the way we actually managed to get that through, because the faculty were convinced that they also might have needs for themselves or their spouse, et cetera. Not so much for the babies. Certainly the men were not thinking so much that, but they knew that that would happen. And we were very definite about getting some sort of parental leave or recognition for fathers, because when we did the 2003 survey of faculty, we found that there had been some good policies on the books way from the 1980s, but 52% of the mothers who were eligible didn't know they existed, and something like 70% of the dads didn't know they existed. So mothers rarely took them, and if they didn't, they said it was partly because those who did know about them, they were afraid that they would be considered not a strong player, that men would that it would marginalize them. And men didn't take them at all. It was just kind of an unknown thing. So in order to change it to allow women to do it, we want men to get in there. So much of this has been focused on men as well. Stop the clock for promotions. That's pretty much the default now. You have to ask to keep it going. So most people do take stop the clock. Not all, but most do. And the same thing for fathers. And the part-time track, as I said, is for mothers and fathers. When we first looked into this, because there wasn't it wasn't clear that there was a part-time way of doing this, we found that on the 10 UC campuses, there were a very large number of part-time professors. But were they mothers? No. They were largely engineers or chemists who were starting their own company, and they wanted to keep their door foot in the door and keep their half-time job, but also start their company. Very, very prominent pattern in many of the departments. So we thought, if they can do it, everybody else can do it. So we did the part-time pre-tenure track. And the battle came down to, well, how do you actually judge them? And finally, the Academic Senate, system-wide Academic Senate, decided in its wisdom that as long as they had the same kind of publications they would if they came through in a normal time, then they were up for tenure. It wasn't going to cut down the number. Numbers were the same. They just could do it in twice the time if they wanted to. Childcare. We have worked very hard on childcare. Everyone does. We have the wonderful new childcare center at Haste, and we have gotten dependent care travel grants for both for faculty and for graduate students as well. And in terms of graduate students, child care is a real problem, particularly infant care. We do give, at this university, a $5,000 to $7,000 student bonus for the parents, student parents, to be able to use as they like, which helps alleviate it. And a number of graduate students have their babies in the infant care center. And emergency child care, this is new, but it is most of these things are not that expensive, actually. In fact, when we were looking at maternity leave for graduate students, I took it to Bob Bergeneau, and I said, you know, we can do this. It's not going to be that much money. So, well, how much money is it? And I'm no mathematician, I promise you. But on the back of the envelope, I'd figured out the number of graduate students who were likely to have babies that year. And we have a lot of graduate students, but still the number is relatively small. And the little bit of money it would cost, since it's only for 6 weeks, and they're paid almost nothing anyway, so it was going to be fairly small. So altogether, I think it came out the highest possibly could be 50, and the lowest was going to be 15 or something. He said, let's do it. Because the money just is not that big. There's always this notion that somehow we can't afford these things, when in fact most of them are very affordable. All these things are fairly affordable. Emergency child care, the same way. It's quite affordable. And it gives peace of mind, I think, to all mothers on campus. Having the rules alone don't do you much good, as we discovered in 2003 when people weren't using the policies and there was no acceptance of any kind of flexibility for mothers or fathers. So what policies alone do not work. You have to make room for fathers. All policies are entitlement, not request. In other words, you don't have to ask your department head if you want to have maternity leave or if you want to be a part-time pre-tenure track. That is an entitlement to you. It's like you have Christmas Day off and you have Thanksgiving Day off. It's not something that you have to fight about or beg for. And centrally funded, if possible, because then, again, the department chair will be much happier. Deans and chairs toolkits. Aha, we have it. Creating a family-friendly department, Deans and Chairs Toolkit. And this was developed here at Berkeley for all 10 campuses. And it has, we've used it at recruitment time, and we've used it at retreat time for the Deans and Chairs every year. So they actually know what the policies are, which is enormously important. They know what the problems are. There's a little of the research in back. And then they know what the penalties are, which I'm kind of a believer in as well. They know that the provost at the University of Oregon had to pay $490,000 to a woman when he said, I think it was the provost, he said, with two children, I don't think it's appropriate that you have tenure, or something of that blatant. Rarely do you hear anything that blatant, but when you do, there is a penalty for it. But the idea was, it's not just the nice, good thing to do, it's the legal thing to do, and there are consequences for not doing it. So this has been a very successful book. People have used it all over the country and just filled in. It's online, so they just fill in their own documents and their own policies, and it's been used all over the place. And well-advertised, publicly posted explanation of benefits for all level of scholars. I think we do that pretty well. For all these levels of scholars, you find it on the web. There are things that are not on the web, which I'm going to talk about because we don't have them yet. One is the dual career policy. Many universities have pretty strong dual career policies that they actually advertise, or at least say what the parameters are in the rules. dual career, which I'm sure many of you can appreciate, is what keeps women often from getting jobs because they're the trailing spouse and they don't get the job. But it's also the thing that makes it hardest for provosts and deans to hire anyone because so many people come as dual careers. We don't do a great job with that at Berkeley. Other universities do because they are expanding or have more land, I think, or other things. But that's a very important one as well. And a high-level administrator and a legal counsel responsible for advertising and enforcing the policies. Well, we do have Angie Stacy and others in the office here, and they've been very good about promoting these policies. So I think we do very well with that. And Sheila O'Rourke is very tough on these policies as well. She was one of the people who pushed through the Office of the President our initial competitive edge. Now here is my favorite poster boy. Those in the history departments will recognize him. This is Mark Brilliant. He's a professor of history here. And I sat next to him at a dinner at Paula's house, actually. And he mentioned that he had been so happy with the policies that he put an acknowledgement in the front page of his new book. First, I knew about it. I don't think he knew who I was either. But when Ezra Max Brilliant was born in 2008, I was able to enjoy him as much as I did during his first year, without risking my career, owes in good measure to the architects of the UC Family Friendly EDGE program. Wow. They designed enlightened policies that children of all working parents should receive, as Esri did, and for which I'm very grateful. I don't think these programs get that kind of accolation very often. It's a good example, though, that here's a father who really took advantage of it, really appreciated it, and will help change the culture because it is a dad doing it. Now I want to talk just a few minutes about the kind of best practices and needs that scientists, women scientists, have, which are somewhat different, although ultimately there's a lot of overlap. Women scientists are, for the most part, supported by the federal agencies. And the federal agencies, until very recently, have done almost nothing in terms of family-friendly initiatives. Only now is NSF and NIH jumping up to the plate a bit, but as you see, many of them do nothing at all like discount caregiving resumes and grant reviews, or provide instructions to peer reviews on family accommodations, or collect data on gender and family status. I've been working with NSF. In fact, I was on a Skype with the Congressional Committee this morning, pushing the agencies to take some initiative in this, because when they see that they're losing their students, they really should do something about it, to work with the universities to do more in terms of the thing that I think would make most difference. They do now offer supplements for the lab, for the PI, for anyone who gets pregnant, so they can pay someone to replace them. The reentry postdoc is what we really need, because how many of you are scientists here? Yes. Do you have the notion that if you drop out for 5 years, you're just dead, brain dead, dead to science, can't possibly be revived? Yeah. I don't think that's so true in law or history, but it certainly is the atmosphere in science. But if you had a year-long or a half-year-long postdoc, could you rev up your mind again? I think so. We just haven't done much of that. So as a routine part of not losing our women scientists, to let them stay out for a while, which many need to do in raising children, but to let them come back as well. We're losing a huge amount of brain power and social capital for our universities. But there are many of these very different issues. This was another survey that we took of all the 13 major agencies who support science in universities and colleges. Includes NIH and NSF are the biggest, DOA is pretty big, and down to USDA. And since then, there has been some movement to try to get them together. NSF has tried to get the different agencies to talk to each other. NASA's trying to do this. Obama's trying to do it. He's been very tough on getting the universities to get together and do Title IX and save women from whatever. It's a good time for this, and I'm hoping, this is really where I spend most of my time now, is with these agencies, that they will be more proactive, because that's where the money is in science, and the rules make it almost impossible sometimes for women. I think the first RO is now given at age 40 or something like that, so it's a very long, hard road, and if you have a child, it's very easy to get knocked off it. And this is what the AAU universities, the 62 major research universities, do now for graduate students, postdocs, academic researchers, and faculty. Only 13% of these 62 give at least 6 weeks paid leave to women graduate students for maternity. I'm proud to say it's Berkeley and one other. The other is Princeton, who also actually give parental leave to men. Postdoctoral fellows 23%. That's not very good either. Postdoctoral fellows have a problem because sometimes they're considered employees, as they are in the UC system, which does give them guaranteed leave. They are staff. They have the same kind of rights. Most of the time, they're considered trainees and have no policies at all. So they are really floating there in a gray area. Academic researchers, 18%, and faculty get 58%. Have a long way to go on all these fronts, but particularly those, the two on the left are the most vulnerable populations. They're the ones who are most likely to lose, and very little has been done for them. Now we've come to my favorite topic, which is new. In the course of studying women in science, which is we've been doing more for the last 3 or 4 years, we've found many things, but one of the things that I kind of stumbled on is that Title IX actually has very strong prohibitions against pregnancy discrimination. It is very strong. How many of you knew that Title IX covers pregnancy discrimination? You do, Bill, because I told you. You did know. No, I don't think so. Even the Title IX coordinators often don't know that. It's really quite shocking. But it's very clearly there in the regulations. It's starting to come through the case law. And it really could transform, certainly, the childbirth issue, because they have very strong regulations here altogether, no discrimination in false pregnancy termination, et cetera, in education program or activity, in employment, this means TAs, RAs, postdocs, et cetera, and medical coverage. You have to treat childbirth as a temporary disability and pay for it with the insurance as you would a temporary disability. And if the student's health coverage covers gynecological care, it also must cover pregnancy and childbirth. So there are really strict rules about what insurance will cover, how you must not be left behind. And basically, the rules say that anyone who has a child, which is usually a woman, must be given the leave appropriate, determined by her doctor or whatever, and must be returned to the same place with no disadvantage. That includes an educational program. So if you have to drop out for 6 months and you're a postdoc or a graduate student, you can't be kicked back or let go. You have to be reinstated and catch up or do whatever, but they have to accommodate you. If you have a job, they have to take you back after 6 months or 6 weeks or whatever and not lose status. These are very strong regulations. And I think they haven't been really found because they're probably kind of difficult for universities to want to have to face. But now, interesting, I just looked at the website of our own wonderful Berkeley before I came because I had seen it before, but I'd kind of forgotten. I Googled in Title IX and discrimination and pregnancy discrimination, pages and pages about Title IX on our website and athletics and what the rules were, et cetera. And then we have a whole Title IX sexual harassment office. So sexual harassment has been the new frontier. But now the new frontier is definitely going to be pregnancy discrimination. And this is what Obama said. We're going to have Title IX compliance. It must be compliance. He went on and on about it. The NASA guidelines, which he recommended, actually include a big section on pregnancy discrimination. So it's just around the corner. This is my, as I say, this is my mission. A number of other people, once they learn about this, are interested in it too. Because it would provide a lot of coverage. As I said, often graduate students and postdocs are not considered employees, they're considered trainees, et cetera, in all the aspects of their work life and in their education life and medical coverage. So you're going to be hearing more about this. You have to have a Title IX coordinator. We have one, but doesn't cover pregnancy discrimination. Complaint procedure, dissemination, and self-evaluation. These are the keys to get going. So hopefully we'll be doing that soon at Berkeley. Here is one biology graduate student. Once I got pregnant, I felt that my advisor no longer considered me a serious scientist. He gave me easy, not very important project, and spent much less time with me. You hear this complaint a lot that particularly in the sciences, that pregnant women feel they're no longer taken seriously. Now, that's very hard to do, to prove. It has to be intentional discrimination, all kinds of criteria. But just knowing that there is a discrimination policy and that we don't accept discrimination, like we don't accept sexual harassment, which changed the workplace, I think would be an important step forward for women in science and everywhere. No, actually, not this presentation. There's a video presentation. We have an NSF dissemination grant, an advanced dissemination grant, taking all of our research and best practices over the many years. And Joan Williams is my co-PI. She runs a center called Work Life Law. She's done a huge amount in creating new family responsibilities discrimination, and gender bias things. So together we have about 8 of these, which are just coming online next week, actually. Do Babies Matter? They're 15 minutes long. They're a video with, you know, wonderful PowerPoints and pyrotechnics, and also some extra teaching materials to go along with them. So anybody can use them anywhere, and they're free. They're going to be on our website next week. Do Babies Matter? 4 Patterns of Gender Bias. Ensure they don't derail your career. How does your workplace mess up? Is a good one. Double Jeopardy: Women of Color in Science. This is really kind of unique and new. They interviewed 60 women of color in science, and she came up with some really quite interesting patterns. Some things are illegal, including pregnancy discrimination and other issues, and it's cheaper to keep her. This is an analysis of what family policies cost, what it costs to lose someone, what it costs to retain someone, what it costs to recruit someone. And it was started at the University of Iowa, but right now our very own Claire Brown in the economics department is carrying on this study because we have some good data about things that have been in place and have worked and how much they cost. And these are difficult correlations to make, and we haven't had these policies for too long, but we're already seeing good things, like these are my grandmother baby pictures. Since 2003, the percent of babies born to assistant professors has doubled. Women. No children in 2003, and now they're, 73% had no children in 2003, and now in 2009, only 36% have children. I think we kind of left that off there. 2009 was that. For men, similarly, 61% in 2003, and now it's only 41%. But the real doubling has been with women assistant professors. Now, I consider that a victory. It's clearly just our new policies that have made it all work. I take full credit for it. But this is what I mean by changing the culture, where people feel it's okay to have children. And at least in the law school, because you have a lot of young faculty, you see the men and women often talking childcare talk in the hallway, which is, I think, pretty healthy for young parents to be able to do that freely and not feel that they are restricted in any way. So I'm very proud of that. Got to go the other way again. Actually, I think that was kind of the end of it. I've lost it. But I just wanted to say, the last thing I wanted to mention. The book is coming out, not actually in May, but in July, Do Babies Matter? Gender and Family in the Ivory Tower. And this is the life course book that I mentioned. A lot of the information you heard today is in it, of course, and then it takes us from graduate school years through finding your first job, through falling in and out of the tenure track and the second tier, through getting tenure, through going through the associate, and then finally the retirement years. And then with a whole lot of suggestions along the way and at the end for how to change things. And as I said, my heart has been in doing more for graduate students and postdocs because, again, you see the most serious dropout at that point. But the book really talks about all the different areas of your life. This is your life. So if you want to read about your life, this is it. Do Babies Matter? I have to say, it's pretty serious stuff. I mean, hopefully we wrote it in a nice, easy way, but it's got a whole lot of graphs and appendix at the end. You don't have to read those. Well, thank you very much, and I'm ready for any questions. No questions, I don't believe this. Yes.
Thanks. It seems like a lot of your data set comes from California, which is fantastic. You have a really large data set, and it looks like you found lots of really cool trends. And I'm wondering which of those trends, in your opinion, would have changed if you had a nationwide data set?
Well, actually, most of this does come from the nationwide data set, the Survey of Doctor Recipients, which is everyone. And then some of the ones about postdocs and graduate students are more from our own surveys in California. But of course, we have huge numbers, so these are important. And I think we're pretty representative of research universities. Because otherwise, if you're not a research university, you're not having postdocs and graduate students either. So I don't know that that's, I don't think that's so far off. Many other universities have used this data and these slides and such, and they seem to feel that it works pretty well for their university as well. So, but that's a good question. I think it's okay, though, from what we know. And the survey of doctor recipient, which is most of this, is clearly everyone, not that you see. Yes, sir.
Thank you for that. And as a young father and a gypsy scholar at the moment, especially appreciate it. I certainly am very familiar with when I have gone off to look after my little daughter and pick her up and things. There's definitely a sense that I get from other staff of, they wouldn't say it, but there tends to be an implication of, well, shouldn't your wife be doing that? They would never say that, of course, but there's always that sort of implication. But one thing I wondered was whether your data was affected or whether the percentages changed or how it was affected in places where perhaps teaching was valued more than research. And how much is this perhaps to a certain extent an indictment on the domination in a way of the research ideal rather than teaching, or perhaps thinking about the balance there.
Right, I think that's a very good question. And in the original survey, the graduate students rated four-year liberal arts colleges to be a whole lot more family-friendly. But the truth is, our survey really does cover them as well, the big general survey about when people drop out, et cetera. And there isn't that much difference between them at that stage. But because we are geared at graduate students and postdocs, these are people who are probably going to go on to research universities, more likely at any rate. But it's a good question. And by the way, thank you for taking your daughter and just being a good role model, because I think it takes a lot of courage for men to do that. But again, once you have three men carrying around the Snuggie, then they all get used to it and it becomes just ordinary. So just becoming ordinary is what what we're aiming for. And employed, yes. So you're the gypsy scholar now. Yes, well, I hope there actually is some hope for gypsy scholars, because a lot of good percentage, it's in the book, do get hired out of that to a regular job. Just not necessarily in the place where you're the gypsy scholar.
Hi. I was wondering if you could measure any effects based on the career of the other partner.
Yes. There's a whole thing, I can't remember all the numbers, but they're in the book, about dual career couples. And not surprisingly, women are more often the trailing spouse, and have more trouble than men do. However, having said that, there are about 38% of all couples, it's the men who are the trailing spouse. And they probably have even more trouble because it's hard for their ego not to do this. There was a good survey that came out of Stanford, and the numbers are just not clear in my mind at the moment, but it is a real difficulty for women. Whether or not they have children, it's a difficulty for women.
Thank you. Actually, my question very much relates to this one. I was wondering to what extent you can separate out the effect, the baby effect from the married woman effect, and the problems of being the particular problems of being an academic.
I didn't put it in the slide because it's too complicated. But in fact, in terms of not getting the first job, overall, women with children are 28% less likely not to get that first job. But married women are 21% less likely than single women not to get that first job. So it does have a strong effect at that particular stage. Later on in your career, marriage is actually a help. If you're getting tenure, if you're going through your associate professor years, I guess it's stabilizing. And older children are actually a help too. But it's those first vulnerable periods of childbirth and getting the first job that really throw women and some men off the track, but more women than men. Good question.
I was wondering if there was an effect about what kind of jobs women accept, like if they go for the higher prestige university, like the research tier or the teaching tier, kind of more what he's asking.
Yes, no, I think actually it's a good question, and you kind of saw that, if you remember it, in the graduate students changing their mind. Well, that one was when they had children, but overall, women who are much more likely to think that liberal arts colleges are going to be family-friendly. So I think they do. In fact, I had a talk with in the biochemistry department a few years ago, And they were all going to go off to four-year colleges. And I kept on telling them, which I think is true from the data, it's not that great. It's not that much more family-friendly. You're going to have the same issues in terms of getting tenure, et cetera. But they do perceive it as being more family-friendly and will more likely make that choice than men will. Any of you ever taught in a small college like that? Is it family-friendly? No, okay. Maybe you haven't. Yes, I think she has a question.
Thank you for the lecture. You gave us more about the difference of the babies affected the men and the women in the university. And also, at the last, you gave many of the strategies how to solve this question in the American. But I think how many of the strategies is only the technical. Only the technical meaning, only a little strategies to change the situation. Not the root strategy, not the root policy to change the situation. So what is the ways to change the situation in the level like the state level? All the mind level, like
how to change the mind? You mean?
Yeah, mind. Uh-huh. Like the men and the women can also do some the cause, do some cleaning the floors or other things. Sorry.
Well, that's okay. I'm not sure I understand everything, but changing the mind and heart as opposed to just the technical interventions is what you say. And I always think of the civil rights movement when people said you can't legislate morality and you couldn't make people less racist just by passing laws. But ultimately, when you live with new rules, you come to accept them and it does change things. So the rules themselves do change the nature of the mind and heart if you keep trying all the time and not let it go. I'm not sure I understood the rest of your question, but is that okay?
She mentioned strategies.
Okay. Strategies. I actually showed you the best practice, but didn't show how the strategies to do it. The most important thing in my experience is to make sure that you get the head leadership in back of it. We started with Atkinson, who was the office of the president, and he verified it, so the chancellors kind of have to step in line. And this is a big system, so getting the whole thing to run together was very difficult. And then when we did the UC faculty survey, it was kind of a bonding experience because we sent it out in Atkinson's name, that you must fill this out, and sent it back. And of course, we got a paltry response because faculty don't ever fill out surveys, et cetera. So then we sent it out again in the chancellor's name. We got a few more back. Sent it out in the dean's name. We kept on going back and forth and trying all the authorities we could. And then finally, the payroll officer sent it out and said, you will not get paid unless you send this in. No, I'm teasing about this, but I'm not about getting the higher leadership involved, because otherwise it might bubble up from the bottom, but you're not going to make any progress at all unless you get the head chancellors and the head deans and such on board. So a lot of politicking, a lot of political work to get them. I mean, no one's going to say anything against motherhood. They just don't want to pay for it, and they don't want to be disrupted, and they don't want to do this, and they don't want to do that. So it takes some effort to get people to change their strategies and their ways of thinking.
I know this is probably a very individualized question, but considering that I don't want to wait until I'm 40 for a science PhD, when would be the best time in the career track, do you think, to actually start having children?
Are you a graduate student now?
Yes.
You know, I've written about this. I write a column for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and I always think the graduate school years are probably good years because you actually have more independence than you're going to have elsewhere. The main problem is the money, but yes, exactly. But if you can get decent childcare and whatever, a community that's really like-minded, people who live in family housing here, I mean, it's really quite a wonderful community. And you're not as pressured because you can take longer in your graduate program, particularly since we stopped the clock for all graduate students at Berkeley, so you can take up to an extra year to finish your program. Now, of course, it would be better if you had them when you were in college, probably, but people don't. Just in terms of, you know, being able to not be disruptive to your life. But the graduate school years seem to me to be not a bad time. My students are always a little shocked that I say that. But
We'll see how my husband feels about that.
Thank you, Marianne, for a really interesting talk.
Thanks, Jane.
As a demographer, I just want to bring biology into the picture and note that oftentimes people want to have children and in fact can't at older ages, and that so that I don't know whether you investigate that at all as a kind of element of the model that you put out there, but...
Yes, over 40. Clearly,
but even in the 35 to 40 range, yeah. I mean, it's a part of the picture. So
yes, it is. It's an important part
biology as well as social science. And I know it's obvious, except that people don't always think it applies to them.
I think you're right about that. I gave a talk at the Haas Business School a couple of years ago, and you know, sort of a general talk. At the end, I asked for discussion, and one woman said, well, "How do you feel about freezing your eggs?" And I thought, well, I hadn't really thought that much about it. And then it turned out that pretty much all the women in the room had thought about it. And in fact, someone had priced it and someone knew someone. It really took over the freezing eggs conversation because this was very much on these women's minds that they had to make their career first and they had to figure out some way to do it. And in fact, there was an announcement just a couple of months ago from the America something or another association that it was no longer considered risky to do so. So that's a whole... I hate to recommend it, but it's just amazing that it seems to be, these people are very aware of it. They're thinking about it, not doing more than thinking about it, they're doing it, some of them. It doesn't have a very good rate, though, because eggs, unfortunately, do not freeze as well as sperm, so they get blistered, more than you want to know, I'm sure.
Hi. As you can see, I have my baby here with me. So I'm very interested in this topic.
Good.
I'm a PhD alumni from Berkeley. So my question was whether there was any data about being pregnant while on the job search. It's a delicate topic because, yeah. I mean, people can always just lie and say that wasn't part of our decision. But
yes.
I was interested if you've, you know, asked faculty, you know, asked people, yes, who've served on search committees about that.
Yes, it's a delicate thing, and I've had any number of graduate students ask me, what do you say, or do you say something about this, or the fact that you have children at all? Of course, you don't have to say anything about the fact that you have children at all, but sometimes it's hard to avoid the fact that you are pregnant. If you are that pregnant and can't be avoided, then I think there's no way to avoid it, just to bring it up front. Once you get an offer any place, then you can ask them right away as part of the bargain, what are your family-friendly facilities? What can I expect for childcare? What can I expect for help, et cetera? So it becomes part of the bargaining process. But the early part's difficult because you're right. People are never going to say, I'm not hiring you because you're pregnant. That's a very difficult thing. And they've done studies that, no question about it, women who have children are less likely to get hired for different kinds of jobs, et cetera. But the most, I did have a wonderful story about this. There's a woman, Anna Westport, who I knew her, I'd interviewed her actually for a different book when she was pregnant, and she marched off to the University of Illinois, very pregnant. She said, I got the job and they gave me a whole semester off before I even was there for childbirth, et cetera. So, you know, sometimes I think things are changing. That's the point. Things are changing. We called our program the Competitive Edge because we wanted to say that if you actually have attractive policies, it would be much easier for you to recruit and retain your faculty. And to some extent, that has proven true. One of my favorite moments as dean was sitting next to a young faculty member at a lunch or something. Never met him. He never met me. And he said I asked him when he'd come. Well, he and his wife both came from MIT, and they were both offered jobs there, but they came to Berkeley. I said, oh, why did you choose Berkeley? Well, because you have family-friendly policies, and we were thinking of starting a family. Well, that was music to my ears. He didn't know anything about me, but it is an attractive feature, so if you put it in the market context, sometimes it helps universities get over their reluctance to spend the money or the time, et cetera.
Well, thank you very much, Marianne. Really a topic close to the hearts of many people in this room. I can see lots of nodding heads. So thanks very much. I hope everyone will join us for the reception, which is probably back behind this wall. So we have to go around the corner, is that right? And down the the dark hallway, but at the, am I wrong?
Well, actually, our cater, we're working with a new caterer, and they had a bit of a delay. So as you can hear, they're actually setting up right now. It'll be about 3 or 4 minutes, and then we'll open these doors. So feel free to chat among yourselves, and the minute the food's out, we'll open the doors. I promise.
Oh, you're going to open these doors. Yes. Okay. Thank you.